Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. I have first a quick update on the lack of episodes in the last couple of weeks. I've been pretty sick. I lost my voice for some time there as well, just from coughing so violently. So yeah, now I'm back to things, but that was the reason that I couldn't be recording anything, which means that also had the base training series episode with Jack that we promised you guys was a bit delayed. We're still going to do the final episode, but we'll probably be recording next week, so the week of the new year, and it might be released probably the first full week of January. So yeah, apologies for the delay in that and for the lack of podcasts recently, but we're back and the aim is to be consistent again going forward. Hopefully that's the illness quota filled for the last while at least. But today I have Michele Zannini on the podcast. He returns. He was on a couple of years ago. And in this episode, we will discuss his research recently on the topic of durability. He's published quite a few studies and we'll discuss them, as well as, of course, practical take-home messages for what triathletes and other endurance athletes can do to improve their durability. As a quick note, in case you skip before the end of the interview, at that point, Michele announces a PhD scholarship that is still open for application for a short period of time. And I have a link for that scholarship in the episode description and the podcast show notes with more information for those interested. There's also another link there that Michele provided, which is Female Athlete Survey for both athletes at national and international level, female athletes that is, and for practitioners working with these athletes. So if you are part of one of these two groups, then you can go and fill out that survey, and that way you can help contribute to the research in the female athlete space. So please do that if you can. That would be great. Now, before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel Hydration. They are, as you have heard, the global hydration partner of Ironman in 2026, meaning that you will have the PH1000 electrolyte drink on course, which I think is great because it makes sure that you have more concentrated electrolyte option that you can drink. And this really eliminates the need to carry salt caps or things like that, then you then need to mix into your water on your bike, which is maybe not a big deal, but I always found that annoying compared to either carrying all of my electrolytes in bottles already or just getting a nicely concentrated electrolyte drink from the aid stations. So this really solves that in Ironman and Sentinel 3 events. And if you are not aware, make sure that you head over to precisionfuelhydration.com and check out their hydration and fuel planner, because that allows you to not only get a fuel and hydration strategy for yourself individually as an athlete, but also for the race you're doing. So you can select any of the Ironman or Sentinel 3 events globally, and it will take into account things like environmental conditions, elevation, gain, and things like that, and make sure that that strategy is really more tailored to you and the event that you're doing. And of course, as a TTS listener, you can get 15% off of your products using the code TTS2025. And that code will change, as you might guess, in 2026 to TTS2026. So please use that on your Precision Fuel Hydration order. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Michele Zannini. Welcome back to That Triathlon Show, Michele. How are you doing today?
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me again. I'm good. As we were chatting before, I just came back from a few days of skiing and looking forward to Christmas. And yeah, looking forward to chat with you about all things physiology.
Yeah, it's great to have you on here. Listeners may remember that you were on before in 2023, the summer of 2023. I'll link to those episodes in the show notes. So yeah, there's lots of information there in those episodes as well about strength training, run training, and economy, running economy, all sorts of things. But because we have lots of new listeners as well, can you reintroduce yourself? Tell us a bit more about who you are.
Sure. Yes. I'm a lecturer in applied sport and exercise science at the Open University in the UK. And I'm also a visiting research fellow at Loughborough University, where I've done my PhD and most of my research related to durability, which we'll discuss today. And alongside, since 2022, I've been working as a head of strength and conditioning and physiologist for the Italian Triathlon national team. And I've been with them at the Olympic Games in 2024 as well.
Yeah, very good, very good. So durability, like you said, is one of the main topics that we have for today. maybe before we actually, let's first remind everybody what durability is. Can you give a super quick summary of what durability is for those that don't maybe are not familiar with the term?
Sure, yes. We would define durability as the capacity to withstand fatigue as exercise continues and accumulates. So you would express it as potentially like the drop in performance or the drop in performance determinants as prolonged exercise continues. So the capacity to maintain physiological stability, physiological parameters that are measured in a fresh state, even when an athlete is fatigued after a given amount of time or work.
Yeah, and that's very good. And in a lot of the research, that well, it can obviously be measured in a few different ways, and we might get into that, but it could be decline in performance, but also decline in physiological parameters. So I think we should also discuss the physiological parameters that are classically used to determine an athlete's performance capacity and that whole model, because that will play into what we're going to discuss next. So can you describe that classic model for endurance performance and the parameters underlying it?
Yes. So in 1991, Mike Joyner, one of the biggest endurance physiologists still active to date, developed this model for which you can estimate endurance performance through three main parameters. These are maximal oxygen uptake or VO2max, the fractional utilization of VO2max at lactate threshold or at other submaximal intensities, and economy. That in the original model of Joyner was running economy because it was based on running, but that now expands on economy or efficiency in cycling, rowing, cross-country skiing, and other sports. And with these three parameters, you can very closely estimate endurance performance, especially when you're exercising between 1 hour and probably 3 to 4 hours.
Yeah, and I think one of the well-known anecdotes or examples of that was Paula Radcliffe when she set her marathon world record back in, might have been 2015 or so, 2014, around that time. And
it was 2006.
Oh, yeah, I was wrong by a whole decade. Yeah, the time flies. But anyway, Andy Jones was the physiologist working with her, and he famously estimated that time within a very close range, might have been 30 seconds or so. Can't remember exactly, but that's an example that is cited a lot to just explain and visualize how, if you know somebody's VO2 max, running economy, and fractional utilization, you can in theory estimate their performance quite well in that time range.
Yes. So and his paper was 2006, and Paula's performance was 2003, and her records lasted for maybe 14 years. So yeah, incredible performance. Yeah. And it's one of those papers that I would always point listeners or readers to, which is, it's a very good way to see how performance can be estimated through physiology.
I feel really awkward about getting the year wrong by so much, but in my defense, I've been kept up large part of the night with a little baby that didn't want to sleep. So I'll use that as my explanation for that lapse. Let's go to some of your research that you've been doing. So one of your recent studies you investigated, you found that if you do people that do regular long runs and a higher run training volume in general, that was associated with better durability of their running economy specifically. So can you talk about this study and these findings in more detail?
Yes, sure. So our idea came from a very practical perspective. Obviously, a lot of marathon runners or even half marathon runners, they would have a long run in their program, and that is usually prescribed to enhance the capacity to resist fatigue. And that is basically the translation of durability in applied practice. So what we wanted to see was if the inclusion of long runs in training would differentiate the durability of athletes. We did take this from a cross-sectional perspective. So we had two groups of athletes, which were very different in terms of training background, but matched for 10 kilometers performance. So each pairs had the same 10 kilometers time, which was about 39 minutes. And the differentiating factor was the exposure to long runs or not. So the group that was doing long runs, they had to do at least one long run per week, and it was a run above 90 minutes of duration. And the non-long run group was only allowed to have sessions lasting up to 70 minutes. We took data retrospectively for the 6 months before the visit, and we used that as parameter. From there, we designed a study for assessing their durability. So we got the initial visit, which was just a step test and maximal test to assess physiological parameters in a first state. And then we've had a prolonged run of 90 minutes at lactate threshold. So just at the very start of the heavy intensity domain, which is very close to what they would expect to be doing in their marathon performance. And we measured the economy every 15 minutes and then compared the economy from start to 90 minutes between groups.
And I think one important thing to point out here is when you say lactate threshold, we're talking about the first lactate threshold because you use the threshold turn point terminology. I think a lot of listeners are more used to the lactate threshold as identifying the second threshold or your FTP in cycling terms or... But here we're talking about the first threshold. So yes. Yeah, that's an important distinction here.
Yes, lactate threshold, which is basically when the blood lactate start accumulating in the blood. So you would measure it from an increase of baseline of 0.5 millimoles, or we use the log-log method, which is a bit more mathematical, but it's very similar. And as intensity, as percentage of VO2max, that was about 80% of VO2max in our study.
Yeah, yeah. So can you elaborate then on the results and the findings?
Yes. What we found was a very clear difference between groups. So in terms of changes from fresh, and we're speaking about running economy here, the group that included the long runs only drifted up, so had a worsening of economy by 3%, whilst the group that didn't do the long runs had a worsening of 6%. So about 50% higher drift, 50% lower drift from the long run group compared to the non-long run group. There was a difference in running economy at the baseline. So even when they started, there was already a big difference in the cost of running, which I think it may have contributed slightly to the differences because the long run group had a better economy from the start, which means that they would use less energy during that duration. And we've also found a difference in the neuromuscular capacity or strength-related capacities. So we've measured the maximal strength and power before and after the exercise. And here again, the group that was used to do long runs had much lesser decay or much lesser drop in neuromuscular function compared to the control group. So in this case, the non-long run group.
Michele, can you explain the relevance of that test, the neuromuscular capacity?
Yeah, so because running economy depends a lot on neuromuscular function, neuromuscular factors, we thought of measuring this change and see if that would relate to the changes in economy. What we found was that there was an agreement in terms of, economy changes and neuromuscular function changes, and both differentiated the groups. However, when we ran correlations across the whole cohort of athletes, that was 13 plus 13 athletes, so 26 in total, we found no correlations whatsoever in the change of running economy versus the change in neuromuscular function. And to me, that just kind of point towards how multifactorial is running economy as a measure and how difficult it is to kind of estimating it through a single factor. So we know that neuromuscular function at some extent underpins economy, but then in this study at least, that didn't really explain the changes in economy that we found during the prolonged exercise.
Yeah, I think that the difference in economy going up or being impaired by 3% in one group and 6% in the group that didn't do long runs, the practical takeaway or the comparison here with the Paula Radcliffe example and the classic model is that someone like Paula Radcliffe, you maybe have a better idea, but maybe her economy would have only drifted by 1% or so over the entire marathon, to, and that is the reason that, or even less potentially, and that is the reason that the classic model worked so well. When you're taking an athlete that doesn't have that extremely good durability of economy, among other things, then the classic model stops working after a certain point. So, for example, if you take somebody whose economy gets impaired by 6% over a 90-minute run, then, or a marathon, it's probably going to impair even more. So then you can't really use the classic model to accurately predict the marathon time anymore, because the classic model doesn't account for this drift. And that's where the whole durability research comes into play and becomes really interesting.
Yeah, it's. I'm just going to jump in on this because it's a very important observation. So yes, 100%. Basically, you can measure the lactate threshold 1, as we were speaking about before, to anyone, even like a person that never ran. They would have metabolic steady state at a certain speed, but they would not be able to sustain it for a marathon because they don't have that capacity to resist fatigue, which is why the models don't really work. If you assess the threshold and you tell an athlete, oh yes, you can run a marathon at this speed, they would not be able to do it unless they train for it. And going towards the extremes of physiology and durability, there's a very good case studies on Magnus Ditlev, Ironman triathlete, that Peter Christiansen published last year. And they simulated an Ironman before the Challenger Roth, when he's done a kind of like world record performance or like a best performance in the Ironman recorded up to date. And at the end of the marathon, at the end of the Ironman, his economy only drifted up by 1.8%, I think. So that points towards what you were saying. Models work very well with elite athletes because they don't have a large decay in performance. But as performance changes, you probably have to adjust the model. And yeah, I would highly suggest you to get Peter on the podcast because he's great. He works for Team Denmark as a physiologist and he's done loads of applied work in this space.
A great tip. I'll try to contact him. Do you think that the ultimate or one of the goals of the whole durability research is to create a new model that where you could potentially test an athlete for the classic parameters and their durability and then model these things more accurately, even for athletes that don't have that elite level durability?
Yes, I think it's already happening in cycling because you have a lot of power data. So in this case, you have a decay of maximum mean power, which can be for 10 seconds, 30 seconds, 5 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever duration you want. And there's a clear difference between elite or world tour athletes compared to junior under 23 and so forth. So they are already working in that space. From a more like a mechanistic or physiological perspective, the test needs to be very specific to the demands of the trial. So the case study I just mentioned from Magnus Ditlev was designed in that way, which is why it was effective. But you, especially in highly performing athletes, you probably need to push an athlete very close to the limit to be able to see some changes. So we need to fine tune testing to be able to optimize the information that we can give to an athlete and not making it too challenging for them. Because if you take a marathon runner and you ask them to run 35 kilometers at marathon pace, that is basically running 80-85% of a marathon, which is very long, requires a very long recovery thereafter. So yeah, I think we need to fine tune what can be used from a training, from a testing perspective, and how that can be practically used in training in elite athletes, especially in lesser performing athletes. I think it's a bit easier because they would have a drift much earlier. But yeah, in my opinion, we would eventually start developing sport-specific protocols that can be used to estimate durability and factor that in for performance.
Yeah, makes sense. So to wrap up this discussion on this first paper, what would you say are the main takeaways from it?
I would say a couple of takeaways, really. Do your long runs, and we can get into the training of that if we have time. But yeah, you need to do long runs to be durable. The other factor that we didn't touch on, but was different between athletes, was that the groups differed in terms of running training volume. So one group was running 51 kilometers a week. The other one was running 30 kilometers a week. Long run, 30, 51, non-long run group, 30 kilometers a week. And that may also be contributing to durability. So higher training volumes may contribute. And indeed, when we ran correlations between changes in economy and the longest long run, that was the factor that was correlating the most. And the second one was the total training duration. Now, it's very difficult to get anything out from a cross-sectional study in terms of correlations. So I would be very careful in interpreting that. The next step would be then to do a training study for which one group has an introduction of long runs in the training, whilst the other doesn't.
Yeah.
And that could be something that we'll do in the future.
It's interesting, though, that these two groups had the same 10K time. So do your long runs. But if you're time crunched and you're doing shorter events, maybe you can get away with without it up to 10K at least. But then again, if they were doing 39 minutes 10Ks, then probably their half marathon time would be around 1:25 or so, which is similar to the 90-minute test that you did, where you already started to see a difference. So if these runners then wanted to do a half marathon and perform at their best, then that lack of long run, lack of a long run would really start to show, I guess, for the group that doesn't do it. Does that make sense?
Yes, and it's also about what these athletes are training for. In the 10K was the trade-off distance that we could get people that wouldn't do long runs, and most of these athletes would be like track athletes, so mainly training for maybe 1500, 800 meters. And maybe somebody for 3 and 5K. But yeah, obviously, it's very, very hard to find athletes that don't do long runs and prepare a marathon or a half marathon because of what we said before.
Yeah, yeah. Then you did another study where you measured, you did a 90-minute run and a 120-minute run in a group of really well-trained runners, and you measured the durability of all of those physiological determinants of performance, VO2 max, fractional utilization, and economy. So can you discuss this study, a bit more details on what and how you did it and the results of it?
Sure, yes. So this was another study that we published recently, and we've got 14 well-trained marathon runners. The average marathon time was 2 hours 46, 4 hours 47, and to be included, they needed to be able to have run a marathon under 3 hours in the, I think, 6 months before starting the study. And what we did, as you mentioned, was having the first test as just like a regular physiological test to assess economy, thresholds, and VO2 max. And then we got a preload of 90 minutes or 120 minutes at a speed within the heavy domain. So that was 10% delta between lactate threshold 1 and lactate threshold 2. So really just above lactate threshold 1 to be very close to the marathon intensity. And then after that, we done the step and maximal test again to assess how physiological determinants changed.
And what did you find?
Yeah, we found that parameters were already altered after 90 minutes, which we kind of expected based on previous research we've done. But even more interestingly, after 120 minutes, the changes were much more exacerbated. So if you take something like VO2 max, that changed by 3% after 90 minutes and 7% after 120 minutes. So the decay was almost four times quicker between 90 and 120 compared to 0 and 90. The same happened to speed at lactate threshold, which we used as a proxy for performance based on Joyner's model. And for fractional utilization at lactate threshold, which slightly increased. So they started at 80% VO2 max as a speed at lactate threshold, and it ended up being something like 84, 85%. So that was due, in my opinion, mainly to the decrease in VO2 max. So your ceiling, the maximal capacity goes down, and therefore your percentage of max increases. And then because of decay in economy, that speed at threshold also decreased, which was kind of like a trade-off for which the percentage of your Tmux threshold didn't go up massively, let's say. We also measured fractional utilization at the speed of the trial. So basically, we got up is running and we measured the respiratory gases at, start 90, 120 minutes. And then we calculated the fractional utilization as the actual VO2max measured at that time point versus the cost of running at that time point. So at fresh, you've got VO2max fresh and economy fresh. Then you've got VO2max at 90 minutes and economy at 90 minutes. And then you've got VO2max at 90 and 120 minutes and economy at 120 minutes. And we can calculate the fractional utilization at the speed of the trial in that way. And what we found was that the intensity of exercise increased from 79% at the start all the way to 91% after 2 hours. So that is a drastic increase in exercise intensity from the bottom of the heavy domain all the way to the top of it, with some of the athletes that certainly exercised in the severe domain, which basically means that these athletes would eventually have to cessate exercise because they would reach exhaustion in probably like 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating that the drift is so large, and even that example of VO2 max increasing, the rate of decreasing VO2 max being four times faster between 90 and 120 to compared to 0 to 90. It just shows that. But I guess I don't know if you did you check this with the runners' training, their training logs, their typical training. Does that have a relation to their typical long runs, the duration of their typical long runs, that some runners maybe were able to have a lower rate or a bit smaller difference from 0 to 90 and 92 to 2 hours if they were really doing longer long runs, like 2 hours plus? Is that something that you looked into at all?
We didn't look into that just because the sample size was too small. We had 14 athletes the study wasn't designed for that. As I said before, I'm always quite skeptical or dubious when we have correlation studies with less than 20 people, less than 30 people, just because there's a lot of noise that can influence the outcome. So I think it's interesting and it's something that we discussed for the future. But yeah, it wasn't possible to do it in this study. There was another study that has been recently published by Ben Hunter in European Journal of Sports Science, where they've got a durability test of 90 minutes, measured the changes in parameters as we did, and then correlated with marathon performance. What they found was that the change in the speed elastic threshold from 0 to 90 minutes in their durability test correlated to marathon performance. So I think that is an insight of, durability can actually be important for performance because of this relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. So what would you say for this study would be the main takeaways, and especially if there are any practical takeaways for the listeners?
Yeah, I think the time-dependent changes of the physiological determinants is the most interesting part. So all these parameters, economy, speed at lactic threshold, VO2max, fractional utilization, they do seem to change in a non-linear way. Well, economy did change in a linear way, but everything else didn't. So again, for testing, if you want to test durability, you probably want to be quite specific in the exercise duration and exercise intensity that you prescribe in the test. Otherwise, you may measure something that doesn't reflect the demands of a marathon. And the other takeaway is that all the classical determinants change, and they change in a slightly different way. So fractional utilization increased because of the large decrease in VO2max, whilst economy, VO2max, and speed at threshold worsened. And that has potentially some implications in how we look into the determining factors of durability from a physiological perspective, which we can probably chat about later on.
Yeah. The fact that fractional utilization increased, would you interpret that as Is that an independent mechanism, or do you think that that's just a consequence of VO2 max decreasing? So it's a bit compensating a bit for the decrease in VO2 max, although it's of course not fully compensating for it.
Yeah, that's a very good point that is worth highlighting. So thank you for that, Michael. I wouldn't take that as a positive. And we've got this question a few times now. To my understanding, is just an expression of how much VO2 max decreased. So your ceiling capacity decreased, and therefore your sub maximal capacity relatively to max increased. But that doesn't. That only means that your heavy intensity or your severe intensity range decreased. So you have a lesser range of speeds, let's say, or lesser change of intensity that you have in the severe and in the moderate. In the severe and the heavy domain at that point in time. So yeah, not a positive thing. Just an increase in submaximal intensity relative to max.
Yeah. So from these studies, and also feel free to cite other studies like you did before in the literature, but what would you say that at this point in what we know from the research are the main things, the main takeaways, practical applications for coaches and athletes in how, if you're, for example, planning to run a marathon, you're training for a marathon, what are the things that athletes and coaches can do to improve their durability or to improve their performance in general in the marathon?
Yeah, I'll take it from a durability perspective first, because that's, I think, a bit newer. And then a lot of it is probably just related to endurance training anyway. So as we mentioned, probably including long runs is beneficial. That is, very simple in practical terms. As we said, everybody would do long runs to prepare a marathon. So you need that regardless of any measure of durability. We still have to confirm that through studies, but it seems to be a very valid logic way of enhancing your marathon performance. Training volume seem to be positively associated with durability, and that's across different sports as well. Accumulated training over the years seem to be another factor that has an influence on durability, and there's a few longitudinal or cross-sectional studies in cycling pointing towards that direction. And there's a few lines of research that are now looking into training interventions for durability. So we've done strength training intervention, which was having a positive effect on durability, both from a running economy perspective and from a time to exhaustion perspective. So we've got reduced drift in economy and enhanced time to exhaustion through heavy strength and plyometrics training for 10 weeks. That was also already proven effective in cycling and cross-country skiing. And from a cycling perspective, there's a couple of studies that found the inclusion of high-intensity efforts during long rides quite effective to enhance durability from a 5 minutes time trial perspective after a long ride. So these are the evidence. From a practical perspective, as we said, just like the typical endurance training for which you increase your training volume and exposure to long runs will probably always have the best effect on marathon performance.
With the strength training, so as we said, we have talked about that in a previous episode, but just briefly, can you give some examples of the exercises that were done in that study with the heavy strength and plyometric and how that positively impacted durability?
Yes, I'll keep it very brief. We've got a very simple design with five exercises. I wouldn't necessarily do that in practice because we have more time and we have more room to improve on and build from one exercise to another. But in that study, we've done a half squat, we've done single leg leg press, we've done an isometric calf raise for the maximal strength side, and we've done a progression of vertical and horizontal plyometrics from the plyometrics exercises. So pogo jumps and then drop jumps. From the horizontal plyometrics, we've got variations of bounds and hopes that would progress over the weeks, basically.
So when you say that you wouldn't do that in practice, would you still do those same things, but just add a bit more depending on the athlete and the goals? Add more exercises and so on.
Yeah, it's a good starting point, but I would include some power training. I would include potentially some strength endurance training towards the end of the sessions or towards the end of the periodization block before the races. And maybe just having something more for the posterior chain. So something related to like a hip thrust or a deadlift, or maybe even moving from a regular squat to a Bulgarian squat to have a single leg exercise built from that. It's just very difficult to do that in research because by the time an athlete learns the new movement, you've already lost 1 or 2 weeks of training adaptations. So yeah. We had 10 weeks for the training and intervention. I would probably work with an athlete for 6, 8, 9, 10 months to build strength and maybe even over multiple years. So it's a kind of, yeah, different approach in practical terms.
Yeah. Can you define a bit the parameters for the strength endurance work that you do? Like how many reps, roughly what sort of weight, relative intensity would you use there?
Yeah, it's something that I'm experimenting, really. There's not much evidence that strength endurance is effective to improve performance. And in my opinion, that's because it's just like usually you do your strength endurance for 10 weeks and we'll see what happens. If it's periodized with the building of maximal strength, power, and then strength endurance, I think it makes sense. And the approach I'm taking is just to work on the muscles that tend to fatigue earlier. With the activity you're doing. So working with the triathlon team, what I've been trying to do with some of the athletes we work with is having strength endurance, capacity development with the calf and some of the upper body muscles that are basically necessary for the swimming push and pull. And you would build something like from 40 all the way to 100 reps and maybe get a couple of sets in the training sessions and repeating it maybe once, maybe twice a week. That typically has some soreness, at least like the couple of days later when you start with it. But they do disappear after 2 or 3 sessions, which is what you'd expect. I cannot tell you how effective this has been because it's always very, very difficult to link any performance improvement, even in training, to one specific training stimulus, but I think it makes sense from a periodization perspective. So that's why we've been trying to play around with it a bit.
Yeah, and I think the reason that I ask is that I'm curious. I've also been experimenting a bit, and I think for Ironman, it's so common that it really is just muscular breakdown that is the limiting factor on the marathon in particular. But obviously, the bike has an influence on that. So I think logically it would make sense that strength endurance would potentially be helpful there. So yeah, it's interesting to hear how you're doing it, and I'll try to use some of those ideas maybe and see how it works. Yeah, so there was another intervention there that I wanted to ask a follow-up question about. I'm trying to remember which one it was. Strength training. Can you remind me which potential intervention? Oh, now I remember.
Yeah,
so it was the efforts. Yeah, intensity late in long rides. That is, you said high intensity, so I assume in the severe domain?
Yeah, there's a few studies from Ben Tronestad group in Norway, and I think the lead author was Nikki Almqvist, that is now based in Denmark. And what they've done was having like sprint interval training included doing these long rides, maybe like 3 or 4 hours long rides. And they would have sprint interval training maybe every hour for maybe
that months. I think was three times 20 seconds every hour with 4 minute rests between sprint. For 30 seconds. It's 30 seconds, I believe.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly the design, but they showed a positive effect on the fatigued efforts that they would test pre-post intervention.
Yeah. Is there anything else? The Nikki, that study we have covered on the podcast, Nikki was on in back years ago, talk about that. So I'll link to that. Is there, what are the other examples, if you remember something about the protocols with using efforts in long rides or runs.
Yeah, there's nothing in runs really at the moment. But yeah, they published 3 or 4 studies which were very similar in design. They only had slightly differences in terms of when they were doing it in the season. I think some of them were like pre-season and like the maintenance of physiological determinants, and others were like doing altitude training camps. So the design was very similar. And it was quite interesting because over like only 2 or 3 weeks, they would have these adaptations. And to me, physiologically, that could be linked to the fact that you're using type 2 fibers more heavily early on, which depletes muscle glycogen and creates a lack of homeostasis, which then these fibers need to adapt over time.
Yeah. Is there anything, are there any interventions, potential interventions that you think would be interesting to study, even though they might not have been studied yet for durability?
Long runs. Very simple. Long runs, long rides, I think they'd be very effective. And that's a very, kind of like a low-hanging fruit. And then there's a bunch of acute interventions that you can look at. There's some data suggesting that carbohydrate intake is it's got a positive effect on durability, with a recent study showing that 120 grams an hour of carbohydrates had led to a lesser decaying economy compared to 60 and 90 grams an hour, although that also led to a very high GI discomfort. So there's a trade-off there, especially in running, in my opinion, really how many carbs you can get. There's some evidence of caffeine, although it's not that strong at the moment, but you would assume that would have positive effects. And then obviously footwear technology would potentially have an effect. So like carbon plated or generally like plated shoes, you would hope or expect that they would have a positive effect on durability. The evidence is a bit contrasting at the moment. There's 3 or 4 studies that came out in the last year, which either shown a positive effect on fatigued economy or didn't, but none of them on top of my head showed an improved durability. So if the effect was positive at the start, that was kind of maintained or maybe not even maintained in a fatigued state, but there wasn't an effect on the decay from fresh to fatigued.
Interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't have expected that. So, yeah. With long runs, do you think if we take a very classic running program for somebody training for not marathons, but something shorter, this might be like a typical collegiate program, for example, might do intervals on a Tuesday and maybe a Thursday, and then a long run, a steady long run, not a hard long run, even though it might be a bit too hard, but on a Saturday or Sunday. So that would be like a classic program for maybe somebody training for a 10K would also use something similar. So the long run is more of a low intensity, not that doesn't mean super easy, but in the moderate domain, right? Do you think that is there a possibility, and this I'm of course asking you to just speculate because there's probably no research on this, but would athletes or runners be a benefit from potentially including more long runs with intervals, even if it's not training for a marathon, but you do your long run, and instead of doing your intervals on the first day, you put them in your Saturday long run?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's something that I chatted with Renato Canova about it as well. I think it's very advanced as a kind of stimulus, but something like that could work. Basically trying to find a way to fatigue the type 2 fibers. In my opinion, it would be better doing it early on. Other people I chatted with, they said, it doesn't really matter as long as you fatigue them. But yeah, having like some high intensity efforts early on and then having a prolonged run afterwards would potentially have the effect of lowering muscle glycogen in type 2 fibers and type 1 fibers, obviously, which would increase the recruitment of type 2 fibers earlier on and possibly have a larger adaptation because of that need of less efficient fibers. And that's one of the reasons why, for example, in our study, we found an improved economy only in a fatigue state or a potential reason, because you potentially have an improvement in the efficiency of only type 2 fibers, which then shows when you're testing that in economy only later on in a time trial or in an effort, because these fibers get recruited later on. Does it make sense?
Yeah. That does make sense. Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's, I think, from a triathlon perspective as well, because you're always running tired, even if you're doing an Olympic distance. Then maybe it makes even more sense to do something like that compared to a pure runner training for a 10K, for example. But it's all speculation, of course. I think, so one final question on durability, and then we can move on to some different topics. But I asked about the different interventions and what has been studied, what hasn't been studied. What about not just in training interventions, training studies, but in general, what for you are the big open questions about durability that you would like to see answered, whether it's by you and your colleagues or other groups around the world?
Yeah, I think the two main topics which we've touched on already are how can you train to improve durability and how can you do it effectively, depending on the athlete and the type of sport you want to enhance, and how can you test it effectively. So there's a lot of factors that go into testing an athlete, and do you do it indoors, do you do it outdoors, do you try to simulate the same temperature and humidity or not, how long do you go for, how high do you go for. So all these like testing which needs to be relevant for the sporting demands are probably the next step to make use of a durability test. If we get into the details of like ecologically valid versus reliable, I think it's something that it may be worth exploring. Like, do you do it indoors, so well controlled and replicable, or do you do it outdoors with maybe some like indoor testing every, I don't know, let's say every hour or every 2 hours, depending on what type of exercise you're doing. So these hybrid approaches, I think, are potentially interesting also from a effort perspective and from an athlete, because they don't have to be on a treadmill for that long, or they don't have to be on a kicker for that long. And from a physiologist perspective as well, because there's a lot of time in the lab if you just have to be there with the athlete. Instead, if they come in and out, there's other things that can happen in between, which would save a bit of time.
And this is the approach that
I don't remember, sorry.
This is the approach that they used in the Magnus Ditlev study, I think, yes. Hybrid yes. Model.
Yes, correct. And then, yeah, probably just like field data. They've done it a lot with cycling to model estimating performance. And I think that could be used beyond cycling. They've done something similar with running, although it's a bit more tricky. And I don't think they found something quite as stronger in terms of data compared to cycling, because running speed, it depends on a lot of factors, whereas running cycling power, it's one of the best parameters to estimate performance. And the same for triathlon. Like if you were to be able to have this data from a triathlon race, both at the Olympic distance level and long distance level, I think there'll be a lot of important takeaways that can be used. One last thing that I think it may be worth chatting or just like pointing towards is the terminology part. We've been speaking about durability all this time, but in the literature, there's groups that refer to this as durability and others that refer to it as physiological resilience. These two terms are now kind of used interchangeably, although I think most people would speak about durability. And what we've tried to suggest in a recent response to a viewpoint in the Journal of Applied Physiology, together with Andy Jones and Lars Nybo, which I think you both had as guests, was that the suggestion would be to maybe use physiological resilience for the physiological factors underpinning performance. So as we said throughout the podcast, economy, VO2 max, and fractional utilization. and use durability for anything related to performance. So that would be a time trial, time to exhaustion, a race outcome, or speed at the threshold, or speed at lactate turn point. So yeah, we basically suggested two slightly different terms in order to differentiate. And that was on the basis that if you have a change in performance, let's say lactate, speed at lactate threshold, that may be underpinned by different parameters in terms of physiological determinants. So an athlete may have a larger decay in VO2 max, whilst another may have a larger decay in running economy. So yeah, having the underpinning from a physiological perspective may help dictating some training planning for the future.
Yeah, yeah, no, that makes sense to clear that terminology up a little bit. Let me ask you a few things about more practical training, coaching, and some science things as well. So since we last spoke two and a half years ago now, I think, is there anything that you've changed in your coaching approach? Anything that, or evolved, tweaked? Any interesting things that you've implemented or experimented with and think are working well? I'm just curious to hear about that.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I've not been doing that much coaching. Obviously, I'm involved with the triathlon team, but I'm not doing the endurance coaching part. I do work with some non-professional athletes. The approach has been quite consistent over the years. Yeah, I think it's potentially more about on the support to the athlete. So having a more thorough understanding of what their response is when they race. So again, like tracking races, and we've done it with triathlon with Stride, so like a power meter to look into the pacing. I think there's potential now to look into like even how effective is carbohydrate ingestion, what rate of carbohydrate ingestion is the most effective for an athlete. Testing this durability side, which we've not really done, but I think it could be important to differentiate even, especially like young athletes. So what we see in terms of performance is that maybe some young athletes would do pretty well in mixed team relay or in a sprint triathlon, but then when they move to the Olympic distance, they really struggle. And then, yeah, from a strength training perspective, as I said, we started implementing a little bit more strength endurance, and we've used the velocity-based training in the past three, four years, to give some objective feedback to the athletes, and that helps in terms of giving a feedback to the athlete on the lifts, and because of some fatigue thresholds that we set, sometimes we may just reduce the total training volume, which I think it can be beneficial in terms of overall optimization of training interventions and training prescription, as well as allowing us to adjust the weight based on how fatigued they are when they come in the gym. So if they lift at a slower speed with the same weight, we may want to drop the weight, and we can do it right away, maybe even from the warm-up, rather than just going for this prescribed weight, which may not be optimal because of the fatigue that they've got from a session before.
Mm. For listeners that are not familiar with velocity-based training, it's basically you're measuring the speed of the lift, and then a classic example that you said there is that you set a certain fatigue threshold that when the lift gets slower than a certain level that you determine, then the set is over instead of, or the exercise might be over instead of having predetermined, let's say, 6 reps, but you might, after the 5th rep, you're too slow, so then you stop there. Is that a good explanation of it in simple terms?
Yes, we can keep it that way. And I'm sure that if somebody is interested, they'll find loads of information online. It's basically based on the relationship between the force and the velocity of an individual athlete, and how this is linear. And therefore, if the speed is lower on a given day, then probably the maximum capacity is lower. And therefore, you have to adjust based on that.
I was looking into actually some devices for that some time ago, and I saw that some of the really interesting ones seem to have closed shop. I can't remember any, with what the brand was called or the brands were called. I think there are a couple that have stopped. But so I'm just curious, what equipment are you using for your velocity-based training? What device?
We use a linear encoder. So there's two type of equipment, really, accelerometers and linear encoders. The accelerometers estimate the speed of the lift based on a bi or tri-axle accelerometry. With the linear encoder, you have a string that is attached to the barbell or to whatever part of the body that you're moving, and it tracks how fast you are moving the barbell. We use Vitruve, which is very user-friendly, and I think there's a free version for a single use, and then you have a paid version for teams, which we've been using, and it's very user-friendly. So. I suggest it to people that want to get into it.
And what do you think are the most interesting trends in recent years in the scientific world, other than of course durability, which we've been talking about for most of this episode? But are there any other things that stand out to you?
There's a few. I'm just gonna go by memory. There may be, I may be missing some. There's definitely an interest related to nutrition. So that's like an increase in the carbohydrate intake and how athletes can take on a given amount. There's potential, that's possible evidence that even 150 grams an hour may not top up with some athletes that they have a very specific metabolism. I think that's something that could be potentially counterproductive for lesser trained athletes because of how little they expanding in terms of energy compared to elite athletes. So even if 90 grams or 120 grams an hour may be the norm for some of the like elite triathletes or elite cyclists, that doesn't mean at all that an amateur triathlete would benefit at the same extent. And they may actually have like a much higher GI discomfort because they just cannot intake that much, and they don't even need to intake that much. There's a sodium bicarbonate that has potential, positive effects on shorter races like middle distance races, and potentially up to even maybe the marathon. There's a very little evidence on that, but I think there'll be something coming up in the near future about it. Shoes technology, we have a lot of evidence that it has a very positive effect on performance, but we'll see what happens from a durability perspective. When we look into training, there's a series of longitudinal studies that are coming out on like world-class athletes, which to me are very interesting, and they're telling us how elite performance can progress over time. There was very little up to maybe 10 years ago on this, and now it's increasing. So something that, maybe it doesn't have that much impact on like a training protocol itself, but it's more about, this is what becoming a world-class athlete takes. And there's a lot.
It helps to visualize the big picture, right? Yes. The very big picture in the zoomed out perspective.
Yes. And to me, all these studies, they always come back to the fact that beyond your engine, your physiology that needs to be very good, you need to have 10 plus years of consistent, regular, high volume training. Another trend, not necessarily trend, but something that came up more recently is about like very high volumes across a season. So there's a few studies now looking into like energy expenditure over a year or over a very long period of time, which somebody say it's beyond the 2.5 times your resting metabolic rate. I don't know if you want to get into this, but basically there seems to be a like metabolic ceiling for which one athlete can consistently only go beyond their metabolic rate, resting metabolic rate, 2.5 times. And if you go beyond that even more, then you start losing weight, and basically the training is not effective anymore. There's a big study that they've just done with Bas van Hoorn, which proven that with elite cyclists, whereas there's a couple of case studies that point towards 2.7, 2.8 times the resting metabolic rate may be possible for some periods of time. Yeah, I think these are some of the areas that are quite interesting and that they may gain more interest in the future.
Yeah, I was never so convinced by that whole 2.5 times resting metabolic rate because it just seemed like more observational, but there wasn't really anything to me to suggest that it was really a true limit. And now there are, as you say, several examples of people clearly exceeding that over long time durations. So, I mean, you could argue that, well, maybe they are extreme outliers, but I think it's more maybe training methods, but also nutrition has changed a lot. I think that probably has a huge impact on that, which probably makes it easier. Yeah, I don't know. It is probably... I didn't find it super convincing at the time, I remember, but I haven't looked into the original research in quite some time. So I honestly don't remember the details too well either, I have to say. But one thing I want to get back to is the longitudinal studies of elite athletes. I also find that to be one of the most interesting types of studies. And I wanted to ask you if you could just give two or three of your favorite examples of those studies, and then maybe I can look them up and put them in the show notes or the links to them.
Yeah, sure. I'm just going to say three that they come on top of my head. So there's the case study from Paula Radcliffe that we mentioned. So Jones 2006, which is, one of those that clearly shows what you can do over time and shows how determinants change over 10 years. There's a big review that came up in 2023, which kind of like reviewed all these case studies or even like proper longitudinal studies on multiple athletes, which were either elite or world class. It was tough 2023, and it was also with Ovin Sandbeck as part of the team. I was in sports medicine, and the same group just published another one on three world class cross country skiers, or maybe like six. So like three world class and three elite cross country skiers, for which they tracked their training and physiological testing and everything over basically their career. Some of them may have been like 15 years, some of them even longer. And they kind of highlighted the different patterns between the world class and elite level. So again, stuff 2025 with the group of Odin Sandbeck, and that was published in Sports Medicine Open.
Yeah, I'll put links to all of those in the show notes so listeners can go and have a look. And then a couple of things before we wrap up. So I know you've been working on another very interesting study that's maybe coming out in the not too distant future. And maybe you wanted to share a little bit about what you're working on there so we know what to expect if we follow you and your work.
Yeah, we'll keep it quite brief. I think it may be worth expanding on that when it's out. So together with Luis Bougin, he's a PhD student at Loughborough. We had a chance to access a very large data set of athletes, which range from amateur level all the way to international level athletes. That was from Loughborough Sport, so the kind of performance and commercial services of Loughborough University. And we've gathered data from about 900 athletes between running and cycling. They've done the typical step test, so they measured the economy, U2max, and thresholds. And we basically just done a very large correlation and multiple linear regression study to understand how physiological determinants relate to performance proxies, by which we define the speed at lactate threshold, power at lactate threshold, and speed or power at lactate turn point. And then ran multiple regression models to understand how much each of these parameters, so V2max threshold, V2max fractional utilization, and economy have on the thresholds. So yeah, we've got other people involved, which they gave a very good feedback. And yeah, hopefully it'll be out soon. We looked into differences between males and females as well, and this basically. The correlations and multiple linear regression models seem to be very consistent between sexes. So although there are clear differences between sexes in terms of physiology and physiological determinants, the importance of each of them on performance, it seemed to be quite consistent across sexes.
Is it too early to share any early indications of those correlations and regressions?
You want a high VO2 max if you want to be an elite athlete. So the parameter that had the highest impact was VO2 max, followed by economy. And although significant, the influence of fractionalization was much smaller. So still important because it had an effect, but nowhere close to VO2 max and economy.
It's interesting because one of the last episodes that I published was with cycling coach Stephen Barrett, who is the head coach for Decathlon Alche Dessert La Mondiale. And he said, we talked about talent development and talent identification. And he said that with the young cyclists, what they look for is VO2 max, and they look for trainability. So actually somebody who has a low fractional utilization at threshold, because that's something that they can then improve relatively easily. But yeah, definitely, he said that they don't really care about somebody having a high threshold, and especially not if it's basically outweighed by a low VO2 max, because that's going to be hard to at the very top to overcome, basically. So that basically, I think that very much aligns with what your study maybe seems to indicate.
Yes, it doesn't surprise me. And what we've done was actually, funny enough, having values relative to body mass in running and absolute in cycling, because they seem to work much better in terms of modeling. And in my opinion, that's because in cycling you have a non-weight bearing exercise. So obviously the test would be on flat. You would have a difference when you measure it on uphill. But yeah, from our flat perspective, like absolute numbers, they seem to work much better than relative numbers. But yeah, hopefully it'll be out in a few months, and then you can probably get the leading author, Louis Bougin, on the podcast to explain.
Yeah. We'll make that happen. Is there anything else that you're working on or that you want to mention?
So there's two or three things that may be worth just sharing. I've got a studentship, PhD studentship on durability that we have advertised until the 16th of January. So if any of the listeners is interested, they can either find that on LinkedIn, I shared it there, or on Twitter as well, or just reach out to my contacts, and I'm happy to have a chat about that. It's a fully funded PhD for both UK and international students. So it's, yeah, potentially a good opportunity. And there's a couple of other things that are happening. We've got a survey on high-performing female athletes, and basically like looking into how research is perceived by high-performing female athletes and professionals that work with them. And we're trying to understand where are the gaps, at least like where people exercising and working at this level feel what the gaps are in terms of research. And then we want to fill that later in the future. So maybe I can give you the link to the survey. And yeah, it would be great if you can share it with your listeners. And then the last update is that me and Renato Canova have finally finished a book together that is now in Italian. It's getting finalized, hopefully published earlier in the next year. But yeah, later on, the idea would be to have it in English as well. So yeah, we'll make it happen. And I think, especially for Canova, that's something that, he needed to share because of his wisdom and how much information he can give you in terms of history of training, history of athletics, and experience. It was just invaluable being able to get it done with him. So yeah, hopefully out soon and then convert it to English.
Yeah, I can already see that will be on all the sports books or endurance sports books of 2026, the sweat science book list and things like that. That will be on top of those. That's exciting news. And with the survey, of course, very happy to share. So we'll put that in the show notes. And when the episode comes out, I can post it in the Instagram stories as well. So just send me the link and we'll make that happen as well. I have one final question for you for a bit of fun, which I've been asking in the last couple of months, which is, tell us where you're based. And we talked before, and you're going to use not where you're based actually, but where your home is back in Italy, where you are right now, and give one sport related recommendation and one non-sport related recommendation for what people could do if they visit where you live.
Yeah, so I'm currently based in the UK in Loughborough. But as we said, I'd rather give a tip about where I was born and raised. So I come from nearby Bergamo, which is in the north of Italy, very close to Milan. And one of the activities that you should do if you're there is just visiting the city and experiencing the ancient town, which is wonderful, and just like have a walk. There's a lot of green and have some good food there. And from a sport-related perspective, I always suggest go skiing in the Alps. That can be close by. That could be something like Bormio or Livigno, which is where the Olympic Games will happen in a few months, or in the Dolomites. It's just, it gives you that feeling of freedom, which I've not really experienced in other environments, maybe with hiking. Just being able to be there with the snow, with a clear sky, is something that, it's incredible.
I actually visited Bergamo in 2014. I did a half marathon in Milan, and then I spent a couple of days in Bergamo after that, and I loved it. I can definitely attest to what you said. I haven't been skiing in that area though, so that's still something to do another time. But yeah, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much, Michele, and especially it being so late in the year and so close to Christmas. I really appreciate it. And yeah. Hope to do it again another time. Hope to get your PhD student. I didn't catch his name, but we'll make that happen when your study comes out. And I'm sure we'll talk again quite soon.
Perfect. Thank you, Michael. Looking forward to chat again. And thanks again for the invite. It's always good fun. Thanks. Bye-bye.
I hope that you enjoyed that episode. You can find detailed show notes on scientifictriathlon.com/673. And as a reminder, in the podcast app, wherever you listen to this episode, if you scroll down in the description of the episode to the section, what should I listen to next? I always put some recommendations for additional episodes to check out related to the one that you just listened to. And in this case, I've handpicked four really good, really recommended science-related episodes. So check them out if that is up your alley. Especially, I would recommend listening to Bent Rønnestad, which is one of my favorite episodes of all time. But there are three other really good ones as well to check out, just generally, not just durability, but sports science more broadly. And also, before closing off for this week and for the year, actually, so Happy New Year, by the way, but a reminder that if you have any exciting goals for the new year coming up, whether they are big or small, and you want to maximize your chances of achieving them or even exceed them, then my advice to you is get some help along the way. I don't think anybody can get the most out of themselves in anything if they don't have some help along the way and more professional experienced instruction, and that includes triathlon. At Scientific Triathlon, we provide that help at various levels, from individual coaching, which is the gold standard and the flagship service that we offer. But if coaching is out of your budget, which is the primary reason that anybody would choose something else than coaching, or it could be some different reason that maybe you just really, really enjoy doing things yourself, then we have other options as well that can be for you, including ready-made training plans that work really well, thousands of users, really happy users, customized training plans and consultations. So check out all of those options on scientifictriathlon.com for more information. And you can always email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com if you have any questions or want to learn more, set up a discovery call with a coach, and so on and so forth. So yeah, we'd love to work with you in 2026 and of course beyond. But this is a good time, even though there's nothing particularly magical about a new year or a new week. But at the same time, there kind of is. It is a good time to start to set a goal, to get a new strategy in place, to implement something, take things to the next level. So yeah, if you feel that that's something that works for you, then kick off the new year in style and get some help from Scientific Triathlon with your triathlon goals, whether it's coaching, ready-made training plans, or something else. And finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS2025. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.